The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill punches cards and the cards punch back. Simpson shuts down and starts up again and again and again. John gets out of the army and gets back in. Doug breaks the rules and the rolls. More fraud, spies, and lies. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, April 25th, I will be at the RSA conference meeting Cyber Companies. Email us at thecybershow.co if you want to be interviewed there. Friday, April 28th, all afternoon, the CSUMB Startup Challenge finalists will be at the Otter Student Union. Contact the IIED at the university for details. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. According to the New York Times, many Chinese have begun using ChatGPT to do their ideology homework for the local Communist Party cell so they don't have to waste time on it. It looks like the Chinese are closing the homework cheating gap with the United States.
And now a word from our sponsor. Tuesday, April 25th, I will be at the RSA conference meeting Cyber Companies. Email us at thecybershow.co if you want to be interviewed there. Friday, April 28th, all afternoon, the CSUMB Startup Challenge finalists will be at the Otter Student Union. Contact the IIED at the university for details. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years. Bill, it's great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm good. Good to see you. We seem to both be doing well.
Yeah, well, not dead yet is what I like to say. Eventually, we're all going the same place. Let me correct that. The same, at least part of the way to the same place. Who knows where we'll go?
Just not today.
Hopefully. Yeah. You know, don't die during the call. That's, you know,
right.
Afterwards, it just increases the value of your segment on the show. So start, if you would, at the beginning of your career. So you must have gone to school somewhere and gotten a degree or something and started working somewhere before you got into cybersecurity, right?
Not really. I got into this field at the age of 17, which would be 70 years ago, working in the brewery as a punched card operator. That would have been in early 50s.
All right, so wait a minute. When you say the brewery, are you talking about someplace that makes beer or something else?
Yeah, someplace that made beer at the time. It doesn't anymore, but it did then. And what was
the punch card operation in the brewery?
Sales analysis. You know, which of the of the bars that sold our beer were giving us the most business, so we knew what benefits to give to them.
And you so, did this on punch cards with what, a punch machine and a sorter?
And a sorter and a tabulator and a reproducing punch. This was really pretty much pre-computer. At that time, we could probably count the computers in the world on our fingers.
No, but you could sort, right? You could do sorts.
Well, and the significance of it was that I was fascinated by the fact that the job-to-job controls always balanced. And I mentioned that to my father at supper one night, and he said, "Son," he said, "you know, those machines are absolutely wonderful. They're reliable and they're accurate, but check on them." And little yeah. did I know that that was to be my career.
Okay. So when he said check on them, did you then start to think about ways to check on them?
Well, yeah. And I've made a career out of doing that.
You've been doing that ever since.
at the age of 20, I flunked out of college and I went to work for IBM Research in Poughkeepsie, New York, with Fred Brooks and Nancy and a group of colleagues. I got a really great job, and I was there until the draft threatened me. And so
and then you went to college?
Then I went to the Army, and after the Army I went back to college. And okay. I got my degree, went to work again for IBM.
Wait, your degree in what?
Business administration.
And what did you do in the Army?
I was a punch card operator in the Army.
Okay. I love it. So you went into the Army, but you didn't go to war.
Didn't go to war. I was too late for, no, I guess I was too early for Korea and too late for Vietnam, something like that. But no, I didn't ever go to war.
Yeah. So you fought the battle of the punch card.
Right. Hmm.
All right. So then you went to school and you got a degree in a bachelor's in business.
Yep. BS in business administration.
Okay. And then what?
And then I worked for IBM selling for 3 or 4 years. And then
selling
I went
what?
Back. Well, mostly punch card systems.
and you knew everything about them, right?
Yeah, and we didn't have anything in our books in those days about computers.
So, Chris, welcome to Bill Murray and the pre-computer computer.
Right. You know, and any real Neal Stephenson fans will know, the System of the World books, going back to the late 1600s and following the actual punch cards that were used in weaving. And so forth in other industrial processes into, where Bill comes in, in the early 1950s, IBM punch cards, right? Computing, but really still electromechanical base. It's the same sort of thing. The information's physically there. It was read, for centuries before by little pins and so forth that made things happen with gears. And the big computer companies, I worked at Unisys a couple of years ago, right? And being there and looking at that and realizing this is Burroughs. This is a cash register company. And you look at the training films and so forth from the 40s and 50s, from the Unisys, the companies Unisys came from, and you see this wonderful combination of machining, parts and gears and levers and so forth, and electrical and then electronic, right? So
the thing is, the electronic is still machining. It's just a very different kind of machine. It's really nano manufacturing. But you're still making physical things, and the bits are still stored in physical devices. They're stored as electrical charges instead of physical positions of things. But it's the same stuff, and you could do the same things then as now, but it was slower and more expensive and had all sorts of other issues. But that, to me, besides the fact that he was there so early, another thing to me that's just fascinating about this is, again, how he starts out, right? Drops out of college, goes to work at a brewery, but his job is punch cards, figuring right. and it's on sales and marketing. And then he right. goes into the Army and does punch cards, which is, I guess, the only game in town. His father teaches him the main lesson he ever needs to know, which is you better check on it.
Right.
Going to do that for the rest of his life, or most of the rest of his life. It's only been 70 years so far. He has some time to go. And then he gets out of the Army, goes back to IBM, and is selling the same thing. So he's got to be like the world's expert in punch cards and everything you can do with those machines at this point in time. And the sales background is fabulous, right?
Right.
So, you know, he's not only been mechanically programming these things, but he's also, you know, learned how to sell them and sell them effectively. To me, that's a tremendous background for, you know, cybersecurity. Because one of the things we lack in cybersecurity, we have all sorts of technical, you know, people that know all sorts of details and minutia that, you know, couldn't sell themselves out of a paper bag.
Well, you know, just earlier today, I recorded a podcast with Joe Saunders, Run Safe Security. And, it started with a conversation inside their company, their group of a school of hard knocks, right? So the interview ends with, you know, lessons, you know, hard lessons you learned and so forth. And it's, you know, so I'm thinking this anyways right now, but, you know, the same sort of thing, you know, my advice there is understand why things happen. You know, if you're a real hacker, you're going to hack policy. You realize why the rules are that way. Learn the programming languages, learn the coding and everything else, but learn how it got there. You know, because punch cards are there because of weaving in the 1700s.
Right? That's right. Yeah. And computers are here because of punch cards. Right. So,
right.
And, you know, I was brought up as an electrical engineer, so I understand how it works at the physics level of when I have to, all the way up to, you know, at this point, the natural language processing AI stuff, which I also understand. Because I've spent a lifetime continuing to understand and re-understand it.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
All right, so John, long time no see. So why don't we start with the very beginning of your life and career and tell us what happened.
The very beginning of my career. I didn't recognize I was in a career until the late 60s. I had been in the military, would volunteer for almost anything, jumped out of airplanes, tried to fly a helicopter one time, and that didn't go well.
So how did it not go well? What precisely happened?
Yeah, that experience taught me that you ought to know what you're doing before you do it. So,
did you crash the helicopter? Or?
Oh, no, it didn't crash. I had a co-pilot that was, I wasn't the pilot. I was the executive attendee to some evaluations we were doing, and the pilot was said, come on John, I'll teach you how to fly.
and rapidly changed his mind.
Yeah me too. So so I guess after getting out of the military, I met a fork in the road, and the fork in the road was, given my background and some of my skill sets, there were substantial offers from government entities for me to join that line of work, if you will. And the problem was the people who really wanted me were all law enforcement. And I came out of a community where law enforcement wasn't a good tool for us. It meant you had to follow rules, and it meant you had to worry about evidence, and you had to do things like worry about people's status, and the political side of it just bothered me. And the second part was the private sector. So I ended up taking a couple of odd jobs. I got my private investigator's license back when you really had to know your stuff to get it, including forensic evidence and a lot of stuff. And so after about 6 months, a year in that business, which was pretty successful, I had a Department of Justice contract. I did some things that were fun and profitable. I met Nancy. And so we're talking now mid-60s-ish. So as newly meeting people will often do, what do you do? And I would say, well, I'm an investigator. I investigate stuff, you know. And she was always satisfied. She taught at the time. She was a grammar school teacher. And very shortly after that came up, we were at a party. Well, just before the party, this Treasury Department contract that I had, you know, they were moving large sums of money and different kinds of negotiables all around the country in trucks and so forth and so on. And so there were about 300 of us that were under contract at various geographical locations that should one of these trucks break down, we would respond to it and provide armed security and arrange for guards to be there. And then we would pick up the what was called in those days the X bags. And the X bags then we would take to the closest U.S. Mint or the U.S. bank, whichever one was closer.
So literally your job was to follow the money.
Yes, yes. And I only mention that because at this party about, well, that happened a number of times, but Nancy and I had a date. One of the calls came in. So I drove by her house in West LA to run into the house to tell her I wasn't going to make the date. And it was warm in LA that day. And so I had my coat off and my weapon was clearly visible. And I made nothing out of it. I didn't know she made anything about it. But anyway, at the next party we were at, I overheard one of her school teacher friends ask her, well, what does John do? And she said, you know, I'm really not sure. He carries guns and bags of money all the time.
Sounds like the mafia.
So I quickly understood what impressed her, or at least what she noticed. Whether it was impressive or not, I can't tell you. I never had the guts to ask.
So, Chris, an auspicious start.
Guns and bags of money, right?
Yeah. And presumably can't tell his, you know, girlfriend what he does, except she sees the guns and bags of money. And what are they called? They're called the X-bags.
X-bags, right? Well, you know, and this is, you know, it keeps you humble, right? You know, my kids, right? You know, it's interesting, you know, all through their lives, like, do you understand what I do for a living? It's like, not really. It's okay, fine. Right. Yeah. They're, I'm sure, you know, she was more impressed with him than whatever he did for a job, and no matter how important it was.
And we'll hear about his, a little bit about his military career before that, but I just want to note that he didn't tell us anything about what he did in the military, right? What he said was he did anything they asked. So yeah, what do you imagine they might have asked?
Right. You know, as I, you know, perhaps say too much, but, you know, again, this crowd of folks we know had just embodies such significant careers, right? And I like what he said first. I didn't realize I had a career until, right? That's a fairly common theme. It's like, how'd you get into this? Well, I did this and this and this. And I was like, well, you know, one thing followed another.
Yeah. And so the question I think that needs to be asked, you know, this is part of what anybody does when they interact with the world. What did he do in the military that qualified him when he just came out to guard bags of money, be responsible for a truck breaks down? He's the one that comes up with the team that goes out and guards the bag of money and brings it into the Federal Reserve Bank. You know, but I mean, what is the qualification for that job?
Right.
Clearly there's a level of trust involved.
Right. Exactly. Well, you know, this is why, you know, the military has so many contacts with cybersecurity, right? You know, it asks a lot of the same questions. It's security. You know, have you thought through, you know, what you would do if, for example, there was a truck full of money, it was your job to not make it empty?
Well, trust, but also skills.
Right.
So what are the skills involved in that, you know, but in the, emergency, there's 30 around the country or something, what he said, about 300. So you're one of, 10 in the state of California responsible for, you know, the area around LA. And so somewhere in the area around LA, a truck breaks down or gets hijacked or whatever happens. And you're on call, you get a call and you have to show up with a team that you assemble in real time from wherever they happen to be at the moment and show up at the truck from whatever sides and take control of the situation, grab the X bags, whatever is in them. And what do you haul them off in? You know, these are armored trucks, presumably. So what do you do? You take it out of the armored truck and now where do you put it? Right? It's over your shoulder and you run.
Well, that's right. You said it right. It's the set of skills, right? You know, it's easy to say, well, military guns guarding, you know, trucks. Yeah. No, that's not it. Right. You know, it's the ability to think about this and say, all right, you know, things are happening now and I need to do X, Y, Z and come up with the answer. You know, the thing of that to cybersecurity and business applications is kind of one-to-one, right? You know, as you and I discuss all the time, if you write a list of everything you can do in security, and you do all those things, you fail, right? You have to decide which, what, when, why.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tuesday, April 25th, I will be at the RSA conference meeting cyber companies. Email us at thecybershow.co if you want to be interviewed there. Friday, April 28th, all afternoon, the CSUMB Startup Challenge finalists will be at the Otter Student Union. Contact the IIED at the university for details. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. This one's going to go under the subject header of just really weird spam. What is going on here? I'm going to start with the subject of this email that I received at an address that doesn't exist, but that somehow ended up being forwarded to me.
Rejection of the readjustment.
I guess I'm supposed to think that they think that I know what they're talking about, or something of that sort. Just really bizarre.
Dear.
Okay, I'm not missing something here. This was just the word dear with a comma and know who it's intended to be received by. Yes, one of those many, many indicators.
My name is Will Iporn. My daughter and her best friend, Ms. Pienprima, are two teenage girls that were assigned to stay at your place during her summer school in Toronto in the next 2 weeks. We are pleased and excited to be there.
Okay, I was planning to send my daughter and her best friend, teenage girls, to stay in your place during summer school in Toronto. Of course, I'm nowhere near Toronto, but who cares? In the next 2 weeks, we're pleased and excited to be there.
We were just informed that our two girls will be reassigned to a new host whose the living conditions are not favorable to our girls.
Okay, as we learned, I guess, in last week's show, the trick here is that they're not using very well-formulated English, and that's intentional to make sure that you believe that they're from somewhere else. In other words, they don't really know the language that well, but they're trying to trust you with their daughters.
We would like to inform you that we, the parents of Pienprima, Salila, and Pimlipus, rejected the latest readjustment that our kids be at Sonia's house. The reasons are as following.
Okay, so now they seem to have three daughters. Wait a minute. We, the parents, and it's going to be signed by more than one of these senders. So it's getting yet a little bit stranger.
One Sonia's house consists of one male member at young age and an old lady. This could be argued that the living condition is quite sensitive for teenage girls.
Okay, so apparently it's not that good a place that they're being sent to instead of my place, which of course I don't have, but that's not going to interfere with their ability to get me to do something, I guess.
Two, the male member in the house is addicted to computer games, which could lead to aggressive behavior, depending on what kind of games he is up to. We will never know until we inevitably face the problems. Although this is arguably not a solid evidence of dangers, it is the risk we don't want to take, in particular with our teenage girls.
So I think what they're going for here is some sort of a sympathy play for somebody who's a little bit nefarious who says, oh, I'll take care of your teenage girls, no problem, send them to me, or some such thing. You know, really sort of wacko in a lot of ways, but I guess it must work somewhere. I wouldn't have gotten more than one copy of it to different addresses.
Three. There will be three girls in the house, whereas one girl has to sleep in a separate room. As above reasons, we are reluctant to allow one of our girls to sleep alone.
Okay, so now there are three girls, not two girls. That's now definitively three instead of two. And, oh yeah, by the way, now one of them's going to have to sleep alone. We don't want them to have to sleep alone. No problem. My daughter will be happy to sleep with, oh, goodness gracious, what are they aiming at here?
Four, our kids come from smoke-free families. To put our kids in a smoking family environment is something that we are not willing to do. Furthermore, Pienprima and Salila have allergic rhinitis, so our doctor does prohibit them living in a house with smoking areas.
So I looked it up, and it is a real condition. So they're not, they're apparently telling us that there's also a health issue besides the potential of having a bad environment for their kids. They can't live there because of smoke. Please, please.
We request that our girls be assigned to the previous host we were informed earlier. As parents of teenage girls, we do not think it is appropriate that the change was made without our consent or consideration. A sudden change of plan with unfavorable living conditions for our two girls are a serious issue for our family.
Okay, so it appears we're back to two girls from three girls. You know, you have to somehow wonder what the real objective here. Clearly it isn't to try to depict something realistic. It's really, I believe, to cause somebody to respond and send them something so they can see what's going on or get you to interact with them. And then once you start interacting, that's when the real scam takes place.
We hope that you can confirm us that our girls' host be the same old one. Had there are some difficulties, we hope that you can find other solutions without imposing it to our girls.
So at this point, they put in some urgency. There's a short period of time. Some importance, they're girls who can, suffer from allergic rhinitis, also known as hay fever. You know, perhaps, you know, be under the influence of somebody nefarious and not be able to sleep in the same room and all this stuff. So they put urgency and importance on somebody responding. I think the psychological factor here is that somebody receiving this who doesn't understand that what it is likely to come to the conclusion that they need to write back immediately to inform them that, look, this is not me. You're talking to somebody else. and thereby engage in some sort of a discussion.
Please reconsider your plan and kindly let us know as soon as possible. This trip starts in less than 10 days, and so this issue is an urgent and serious matter. We are looking forward to hearing back from you soon. Best regards.
Now, to put this in context, I just want to compare it to a different message that I got, you know, basically within a few hours of the same time that comes from a different party. Again, just trying to get you to get back in touch with them so they can solicit you on something.
Hi, I have your email from LinkedIn. Let me know if it is okay for me to forward details of a proposal to your email here. Best regards. Mr. Laurent David, Deputy Chief Operating Officer at BNP Paribas.
Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. Fred here. On April 4th, we have our monthly advisory call for Angel to Exit. Join us to discuss anything you want about your early stage company. Later that day, we'll have the CEO's Forum, where portfolio company CEOs get together and discuss issues and help each other identify synergistic improvements. On April 11th, go to Angel. You can pitch your company, get in front of investors, get on the radio show, and tell the world about your new company. Also on April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist.
All right, so continuing with your career back in time instead of, you know, dealing with today's issues, you got out of journalism school and how
there are no jobs.
Well, right. So you did consulting.
Yes.
And how long did you do that? And what did that ever turn into, if anything?
So I had a professor at MIT. And the first time I was asked to do consulting, I asked her what I should charge. And she said, you should charge $100 an hour. And this was in 1986, back when that was a lot of money. You can do the conversion for today. And I was just completely intimidated by that. I was planning on charging $25 an hour. And she said, like, no, you're the world expert in this thing. That's why they're asking an undergraduate. They can't find anybody else. So you should ask for $100 an hour. And I ended up charging $50 an hour because I was too embarrassed to charge $100 an hour. But I did most of the consulting that I was doing right then was on optical data storage, Wright-1's optical storage. I was doing some work at Polaroid, which, as I had mentioned, had a way of generating low-cost compact discs and Wright-1's media. Developed a whole medical imaging workstation for them, which they were afraid to sell. And so they just demonstrated it at some trade shows and then let it quietly die. But it paid for my first house, so that was kind of nice.
Well, at $50 an hour, that's a lot of either a very small house or a lot of hours of consulting.
I had raised my rate by the time I was working at Polaroid. And it was a very small house. It was 888 square feet.
So, what they would now call a tiny house, but at that time was just a house.
It was just a little house. It was a converted stable in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
There you go.
The carriage house, where the carriage had been kept and the horse, right? So over time, I was able to spend more of my time doing journalism and less of my time doing computer consulting. And by the early 90s, I was mostly supporting myself on the writing rather than on the consulting. In 1994, I got married. It was very exciting. And we wanted to do something crazy romantic. So we moved to Martha's Vineyard and bought an old rundown house there. And there was no decent internet service on the vineyard. There was like a dial-up ISP called TIAC, the Internet Access Company in Massachusetts. And they it wasn't very reliable. And so I decided that the right thing to do would be to have a leased line to my house on the vineyard. And the only way that I could really pay for it would be to put some modems on the router and let other people dial into it. And so I would become an ISP. And I figured that it wouldn't be that hard to get to break even. It turns out that we were at break even at around 600 customers. And at that point, I had a 100 pair line coming into my house. We had banks of modems in the basement. It turned out that it took about 600 customers to get to break even. At that point, I had a 100 pair line coming into my house. We had banks of modems in the basement. The 56K line had been upgraded to a T1. And one day we were thinking about, well, what's going to happen if we get hit with a hurricane or something? We should get business continuity insurance. Called up my insurance agent. He wanted like a detailed plan of how we would deal with an outage. And I realized that the whole process of putting that plan together would eliminate the need for having business continuity insurance. I would just be self-insured and have a decent plan. And so based on that, we opened up a second data center elsewhere on the island. It was very exciting. We connected them with a wireless network. But then the storm came along.
Common mode failures.
It turns out that just having two high-speed data circuits doesn't guarantee you something called geographic diversity. And both of our high-speed circuits were coming through the same cable. And so we were offline for 3 days. After that, I contacted our circuit provider, New England Telephone, 9X. And I said, we bought two lines and they both went out. And they said, you didn't pay for geographic diversity. And I said, great, I'd like to buy geographic diversity. And they said, it's not available where you are because there's only one cable and everything comes through it.
Yep, you should have run your wireless from the island across the water and then had your diversity on the other side.
That wouldn't have done it because the wire was the one that went down the Cape.
Oh, you mean their only wire?
They had a fiber that served.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So yes. That's another one. You know, this is the backhoe disease, right? They also had a backhoe cut in a similar time frame that took them out for quite a while. And, yeah. And very common, right? That's... Yeah. Before they had the infrastructure dial-in stuff where you would, you know, call in to see what's under the street here.
Yeah. So this was, it was all the Cape Cod. It was being served by a single big fiber link. And it,
not just Cape Cod.
There you go.
All of New England has been severed a couple of times in that time frame. But that was long ago and far away. So, all right. So after the ISP.
So I have, in fact, skipped over a lot because, you know, during this time I had been an editor at a computer magazine, and the computer magazine was devoted to black computers, and the computer magazine went out of business, and the black computer company ended up taking over Apple Computer, and so the black computer company was called Next, and everybody who was running Next took over Apple. It was like they were a bunch of pirates. And in the mid-90s, I tried some startups, and they weren't very successful. And one of them was a computer security startup where we decided to do only offensive information warfare tools, hacking tools. We made a wiretapping tool. We made a tool that was a war dialer. We made a commercial war dialer. I have a patent on the multi-line war dialer. Could dial all of Baghdad in 8 hours. That's an interesting number. We had a hard time selling these tools to the government, to private industry. Basically, I decided to go back to graduate school in 2002 and earn a PhD in computer science.
Okay, so lots of attempt to start things and lots of failures. I guess that's not even a little bit unusual.
Not even a little.
Yeah, trying to be offensive. And, you know, but on the other hand, his rendition of history doesn't jive perfectly with mine, having lived through a same period of time and seen the same things going on. I don't believe Next actually took over Apple, you know, and so forth. But, okay, whatever you like.
I like the early ISP days, right? At this point in the early 90s, you know, I was working for Sea Change Corporation, a little 5-6 person company in Mississauga, Ontario, Canada.
and we started selling Livingston Portmasters. It was a 32-port port terminal server, which was built for the purpose of having 32 terminals hanging off some other computer, to someone who was putting them in a closet at One Yonge Street and putting 32 modems on them, right? And then Rockwell NetHoppers to individual companies that wanted to dial into one of these Livingston Portmasters, right? And talking it through then at the early days, like One Yonge Street, the Toronto Star building, you know, has a lot of fiber in its basement, a lot of major trunks, you know, it always has been, right? So you get a certain amount of redundancy because that was there in the first place. But, you know, and the whole concept of, wait, you have a, you know, 100 customers and 30 modems. What if they all dial at once? Well, they don't, right? And that whole thing, right? And it's fascinating that it worked well enough then, it's gotten to where it is now, that, you know, to my abiding theme of the moderate maturity of all this stuff, that it doesn't always work all the time and it fails in fascinating ways right now, that, you know, in 20 and 30 years, I imagine it won't. Probably be still failing
I think it'll fail in different ways.
Like, I think right, you know, at every right now, every 2-3 year period, we're going through a different phase of this, and we're all complaining about different things, and we solve those, move on to the next problems.
So right now, my AT&T fiber connection has been down for about 2 days. After the power was down for about 5 days out of six. But, you know, I have done the redundant internet, so we're running over Comcast right now. So I've been able to continue my business through this stuff. And the tertiary backup is my cell phone, right? And meanwhile, one of my primary backups for my servers is now unable to communicate to the server because it's running over the AT&T link. But I have the redundant connection over the Comcast link. But,
right,
you know, if you don't plan for this, the thing that's wonderful is that the cost is now low. Right. So I think it costs me another $30 a month to have my redundant internet. You know? And so I use a computer that I, you know, my last desktop computer is now my secondary backup computer. And my 2 ago desktop computer is my other secondary, my primary backup. And, you know, and uninterruptible power supplies all over the place. It doesn't cost that much to do it reasonably well and reasonably redundantly today. So I sort of think even for a dinky little business like mine, you can afford to do that. At the same time, you know, people just, the amount of time and effort and thought and configuration management and everything else you have to do to have everything redundant is probably more than most people want to do, care to do, think they should do. And I think it's good to blame the other guy anyway. So all.net, right, my website, comes from All Things Incorporated. All Things Incorporated was in the late 1990s, a corporation that I was the technical guy on and somebody else was the sales and marketing guy on. And in my basement of my leased house in Monroe Falls, Ohio, we had a fiber, I believe it was from MCI, that we weren't paying for. They said, when you get enough volume to pay for it, that'll be fine. They were trying to build an internet service. So we had, you know, I don't know how many T1s worth of service sitting in, you know, my garage or my living room, wherever it was, in Monroe Falls, Ohio, and an old Sun computer that was running the service, and all.net is still here. And, you know, it's lots of transitions, but it's still here. It's been more than 25 years. And, you know, I celebrate the fact that I survived all of that. The reason it's all.net instead of all.com is because all.com was taken by somebody who wasn't using it then, and it has not been used since. But I refused to pay whatever the excessive fee instead of the $12 a year. You know, I refused to pay for it. So it's just sitting there basically, you know, year after year after year with no value to anybody, consuming 7 bytes of namespace.
Yeah, I registered blast.com in the early 90s and in 96 in Utah in my basement. You know, I had I think it was an ISDN connection, a 128 ISDN connection, and a Borderware firewall server of my own that I had kept and was running the domain on that. And the web server was showing pictures of the Shoemaker-Levy comet strike on Jupiter and various links to just random things at the time. And in 2000 or whatever, it was right when the internet was changing over to, you know, You used to have to like just go through this process, like fax, you know, copies of your passport to prove you're you to change you know, change things because I'd lost the email address that I'd used for authentication before that. And I'd gone through all the process and did everything and got confirmation and it still didn't work. And I thought, screw it. It's a couple of days from now. I'll just wait and I'll just re-register it. And somebody had camped on it and was ready to buy it as soon as it's a 5-letter.com. And since then, so for 20 years, it has been a genealogy site or something. And every once in a while, I get reached out to by these folks who want to sell it to me. And it's like, absolutely, not only no, but emphatically no. And you're never going to sell it to anybody else. Blast? Who wants blast, right? It's a Polish word that means, you know, brief flash of lightning. There you go.
Which brings us to the question of the value of these domain names, which I cannot opine on at this point in time, but I certainly have an opinion of, because there's a legal matter in which I am or may well soon be engaged where that sort of opinion has become potentially a critical factor in the outcome. So, you know, so we live our lives and there is no permanence, but all.net is still mine and it's still here and I'm not giving it up. So
Tuesday, April 25th, I will be at the RSA conference meeting Cyber Companies. Email us at thecybershow.co if you want to be interviewed there. Friday, April 28th, all afternoon, the CSUMB Startup Challenge finalists will be at the Otter Student Union. Contact the IIED at the university for details. Tuesday, May 2nd, our Angel to Exit monthly advisory session will be held live online remote. To join us, sign up at thecybershow.co. Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th, at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
Now, onto our next service provider.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena.
Doug, welcome back. We're talking now about roles and rules.
Yes.
So first of all, is it roles and rules or rules and roles?
I think it's rules and roles. That's definitely splitting hair. Okay, let's put it this way. We were talking before the break about an HR being a system or an HR database being a system of record. And that in the early 90s to this day is still basically par for the course. You would have somebody hired into a job. Right. They were hired for some reason and the HR database would say, what's the job? What's the title? What's the description? If you have roles, what's the role? A lot of times didn't have roles, still don't have roles, have crappy roles. Didn't matter. As long as we knew the person started, that they were hired into this department, cost center, had this job, this description, we started to write rules. When we got a batch file, or if we were lucky enough to be able to have an API to have an event trigger, say new.
All right, now, just so we remember, yep. API, application program interface, a couple weeks ago by now.
Yep.
And an event trigger. Ooh, okay. Ooh, now we're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. So what we're doing is listening to the database. More often than not, we would be watching the change log for the database to see if something changed that conformed to our rules.
An example of a change is I get a new job,
yeah,
or I get hired, or I'm in vacation. Yeah.
But we didn't want to concern ourselves with everything. We would have five or six criteria we'd be looking at. New hire, fired or resignation. We would look for job change or some things like that. A small finite number of things that we would be watching a change log for. And when we saw those, boom, trigger. That would create an application programming call to the directory saying, update this data for this record with this. And we could actually map. We could take job description and convert it into, if we had a little table that we created of roles, and put a role in the directory that then the consuming applications would be able to read and make mostly coarse-grained authorization decisions, but still better than is employee, is not employee.
All right, so let's just talk about an example of that in reality, right? Mm-hmm. So you worked for IBM at some point. That was before this.
Yep.
So at IBM, you know, I'm working in the research lab, which you were doing.
Yep.
And now all of a sudden, I'm one of these systems engineers.
Yeah. Yep.
So probably that means I'm not allowed to go make changes in the engineering lab anymore, right?
Correct.
So what happens here is when that job change happens for you in the HR database, your access is terminated, whether no other change has to happen except in the directory. It says no longer one of those. And now whenever the engineering stuff checks to see if Doug's allowed, it says, Doug's not allowed because he's not one of those. On the other hand, now new stuff becomes allowed, right?
Yes.
And then there are a bunch of these different things. Like, for example, because you're an employee, you probably have the right to look at the policies of the company, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're an employee, you probably have the right to put in expense reports.
Right. Correct.
And if you're not an employee, no matter where you work in the company, you're not allowed to. So if you're a consultant, so all these different parameters start to grow. Mm-hmm. All right. So now you talk about roles and rules. How many roles and how many rules, in the beginning would you have in a typical setup? And then tell us how that changed.
This was an evangelization kind of an exercise at those times because, as you can probably infer, it's like a kid in a candy store. You got all of this capability at your fingertips. And what was the phrase? We would be able to program ourselves into, paint yourself in a corner. We had to be mindful of the number of rules and the number of roles that we were dealing with because it could become too complex very quickly. As a matter of fact, in the sandboxes in the early days, we made that mistake and we realized we need to step back. I used the word phrase coarse-grained a few minutes ago, and that's important to note because even to this day, fine-grained authorization is in a general purpose sense is exceedingly difficult to do because oftentimes fine-grained is application specific. So we had to come up with a way very early on to draw a line between good enough, secure enough, and being so secure that it was unusable. Does that make sense?
Oh boy, does it. Because right now they're talking about, this whole zero trust stuff.
Yeah.
That you should have precise access control. But let's just talk about it from roles and rules because there are other techniques that came after that. But just from roles and rules.
Yes.
By the way, the same thing sort of applies in firewalls.
Yes.
Where we're doing things instead of by identities in the early days by IP addresses.
Yep.
What IP address can access which other one. And we had, for a typical firewall for a reasonable sized enterprise, we might have 40 or 50,000 rules.
Yeah.
Right. In the firewall. So every packet that comes in the firewall has to go through 40 or 50,000 rules to make the decision. And then the other thing is, there was no way to figure out whether the rules were right, because if you do it in a slightly different order, it works differently.
That's right. Nesting.
And you can deny services to whole segments of the network.
That is correct.
And making changes were horrific, and there was no analytical software. So now, in terms of people, did you get to where there were – well, I remember you telling me once there were more roles and rules than there were people.
And that is still a problem that ails a lot of organizations today. As a matter of fact, when I go in and work with companies today, it's oftentimes to try to extricate themselves from having painted themselves into that corner. It can be complicated. And so it's not easy to extricate, unfortunately, because you have so many relying applications that you don't know what will break when you change something. So you have to do this in a very, very slow methodological way. Methodical way. Slow and careful. What was interesting? Now, we're still talking, about this provisioning and roles and rules. This was all happening around the turn of the century. So going, good 20 some odd years ago. What happened at that point in time, I think was pretty important. This was when I first became aware of a phrase called risk management. And I kind of hung my hat on that for much of the rest of my career because I was good enough now in the technical sense to know rules and roles, complexity, simplicity, general purpose, special, all these kinds of things that risk management needed to be factored in. Because as I said a few minutes ago, good enough is often good enough. But somebody needs to make the decision of what is good enough. And so I got into the role of proposing these, but yes.
All right. So we're going to talk about this in the next session. Mm-hmm. Okay. So good enough.
Right. Everybody out there, right? You know, go to all.net, look in the upper left-hand corner and click on the word protection, right? You know, you'll see a structure there that Fred's been curating for many, many years that he uses and I use, you know, for cybersecurity purposes, but also for business purposes. And the lesson inside this is interesting when you work with a company or a public-private sector entity and say, look, you're not supposed to do everything on this list. It's not possible to do everything on this list. Your job is to pick which parts of this list you want to do anything about. And even with critical issues like security, lots of things you should not be doing. Now, any one of those things, someone somewhere should be doing based on their context. So it's not about filling in the checklist. You know, that's business or security. You've got to pick your battles.
Yeah. So we've had a lot of experience going into places where you do a review of this stuff and you start asking, well, what are these things do you do?
And all of them.
They want to say yes as much as they can, you know.
Right.
And you tell me about an hour and a half into the meeting, you know, they start complaining and saying nobody can do all this stuff. And at the beginning we told them this, but that's all right. So you say that's why we told you at the beginning. Of course, nobody does all this stuff. We're just trying to figure out which ones you do, and what's reasonable, appropriate for you. At which point they go back and they say, "All right, we're going to tell you the truth now." You know, let's go back like 18 parts here. Yeah, we don't do this stuff really. You know, somebody might do it. And at some point, you break down and start telling you the truth.
Well,
right? The other part of that, Chris, is almost every time, I think every time we've done this, they come out with a list that's way longer than they ever thought they had. And when management sees it, management says, "Holy crap, you're doing all this.
All those things." Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and is that? My God, I had no idea you were doing all that stuff.
Right. To Doug's whole example about, you know, roles and rules, right? You know, if you have five people in the company, I mean, the possible number of roles in a company, and I think the standards of practice you and I use kind of defines that. We could go all the way through there and define every possible headcount a company can have. You don't know if you have five people, or 500, or 5,000. You can't do all those things.
Right. So that's why the standards of practice look at the size of the company, for example, right, and what stage of growth you're in. Yeah. And when we do this for some early stage companies, and going through the checklist, they go crazy. You know, there's like,
I should be doing this. I should be doing this.
No. They say, I'm an early stage company. I don't need to do all this stuff. And I say, we know let's figure out what you do right. So we can figure out what you should do instead. The other one is, many people do too much in one area, not enough in another. So getting that
almost always.
Yeah. So getting that balance, saying, look, you know, I appreciate that you are good at this, right? And you have somebody who works for you that likes this, who did this in a previous job, but they shouldn't be doing that.
Right? Look, if you have a company out there and you engage cybersecurity people, remember the first thing before they walk in the door, you're right. I mean, you running a company, you can afford to hire people. Obviously, you're doing the right things to date. Now, maybe you should change something. Maybe not. Who knows? Right? But you're not behind the ball.
It's not right or wrong. It's that you're successful, right?
You're still there. You're still working
hard. The fact that you've survived this far means you're doing all sorts of stuff right.
Right.
And the question is not, oh, don't do that. The question is, well, can you do better?
Well, because any security choice, a measure you decide to put in place is going to come at some cost. You know, liberty, okay, freedom to move, you know, business opportunities, right? You decide not to do those things because there's a risk there. Well, any, you know, business, any revenue from that whole thing is not going to happen.
That's right. Your competitor decided to do it and take the risk. And this is another thing people in cybersecurity tend not to understand, that risk is something you take for rewards. It's not a bad thing. It's right. A thing. And you need to figure out which risks to take and which ones not to take. That is what path forward to undertake, and you do it better if you're more knowledgeable about it.
And this is where appropriate levels of strategy come in play. And again, as we're saying, you know, if you're just thinking about it, don't spend all your time thinking about strategy. However, right, you know, keep it maintained at an appropriate level to avoid strategic surprise.
Right.
You know, you take risks on purpose, but suddenly finding out you're taking a big risk and you didn't know it, yeah, that's when bad things happen.
Yeah, that's right. That's a mistake. So there's all sorts of lessons that you learn from doing this stuff. And I guess we're going to be talking about that for the next, you know, however many years, you know.
Next week on The Cyber Show.
BM pushes into AIS and ACF too. John follows the money. Fraud, spies, and lies go global. Simpson goes back to school. Doug manages the risk. And AI starts to get headaches. And much more, only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.